Poet Runner. My name is Rafael Alvarado, and today we have for poetry, we have Carolina Rivera Escamilla. And for running, we have Boyd Dunleavy, but that'll come later in the show. Hello, how are you?
I am fine. And how about you?
I haven't decided yet, but I'll figure it out later. Let's start out. When did you first get into poetry? When did you first start writing?
Actually, I started writing, I mean, seriously, like, I think I would say started in the 2000s. But in the 90s, I was writing mostly theater. I mean, we're talking about writing, and writing poetry actually it was started in the 90s. I was writing mostly theater, like a little plays and monologues, and very quickly, actually. But it was until 1999, that I start actually writing stories.
You started with plays before you started with stories and poetry?
Yeah.
How's the structure? How's the structure from, like, say, plays to stories to poetry? There's a definite difference.
It is very different because when you're writing play, you're writing about action. You are writing about put it on the stage, right? And so when I was writing mostly, actually, I was writing to do the theater because I'm an actor. That's what I did in El Salvador, and that's what I was doing. So it's a very different because the narrative stories are narrative, right? So it's a very different structure, both of them. I would say the poetry and theater has something in common because you're thinking, actually, I would say yes, but maybe film, mostly with images. Poetry, the monologues, usually I got it like a poems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they are very different from each
other. Oh, yeah, I would say that. But you also write stories, too. Have you made a collection of stories, or do you just right now? What is your main focus right now?
Right now, I am writing a novel and also a book of. I collected all my poems that I've been writing for a long time, and I haven't published them. They've been published in different anthologies or literary magazines, but I put it together this year, and I have. I want to publish them. I hope that I have sent it out, and I hope that they will be published. But I'm writing a novel too.
So basically, the poetry volume is just going to be a collection of, or are you going to call it a collection, or are you going to give it a title? Collected works, or is it just going to be?
Collection, but it's a chat book. It's about 50 pages.
Okay.
And it's a poetry for theater. I always think of my poems that come like theater, for people to work on it. You can use them as a monologue. So, but it's a structure in like poems, yeah.
You mentioned the theater in El Salvador. Did you have anything like? Do you have published work in El Salvador? Do you have published plays in El Salvador?
No, not at all. I left El Salvador when I was very young. Actually, I went in the late middle of the 80s, and I went to Canada, actually. Yeah, I went to Canada, and then I came here looking for the sun, something warm. But I left El Salvador when I was in my 19, when I was 20 years old.
Do you want to read a couple of the poems that you're going to be putting in the collection?
Yeah, I can read. I can read one. Actually, let me see which one would like. Actually, I have this one that I really like it, that it was actually in the anthology, the pandemic anthology that you guys put it together. Okay, so I'll start it in the middle because it's kind of long.
I'll read the whole thing. No, just read
pandemic.
The whole thing.
Is this kind of long? Okay. Pandemic thought. In the bedroom, I seclude myself for hours. A white blanket mummifies my body. My eyes follow plaster traces on the green ceiling. I wish for wings to go see my son, my father, all my family, fragmented by civil war, post-war, by gangs taking over El Salvador. And now this confinement doesn't face me. I have gone through curfews, exile, believe me. Curfews and exile prepare for confinement. What scares me is the arrogant despot protecting money over life, misleading this country like so many others, killing people for profit. Memories come like pulses of light, fireflies in these days of lockdown. I see mother gathering her children to save them from a military hand. I see father trying to steal a piece of the sky as a roof to hide his children who are immigrating, running from bullets. I remember my brothers hiding in a car's trunks to cross the border from Mexico to the USA. Remember migrants crossing in crowded, broiled spaces of tractor trailers. Many died. Caged children in detention centers pop in, thoughts buzzing in the air in this anxious sleeping space, the weight of a leaf falls. Butterflies circulate near wind chimes, cloud passes by. Hummingbirds are stationed on a wire. I hear the faucet running water. Or is this the garden hose? Francis is washing aging agile hands. Francis is washing aging agile hands for the 10th time in an hour. His hands flutter under water. And I wonder whether they will grow waterfalls instead of dissolving the worldwide enemy under his nails. Confinement comes with other memories. Bombardment by hysteric social media, Facebook, CNN, cable channels, newspapers announcing like coroners of the world, COVID-19 is coming, COVID-19 is coming, it is coming, it is already close. Stay calm, wash your hands, hot water, alcohol, soap. Pandemic virus, pandemic, COVID-19 is killing tens of thousands in Europe. Now it is here in New York City, in Seattle, Los Angeles. CNN flashes images of bodies buried in a mass grave, a communal grave, new angel for our queen. I felt sick for long days, depressed, must have the virus. I must have the virus. How many times has that suspicion crossed my mind? I meet new people in Zoom readings. I connect with some. I have not heard from them in years. When protests come, I scream the worst virus is racist. I scream the worst virus is racist. Okay, thank you. Yeah, this was the one, it's a long one, like I say, but I would like to share something else, okay?
Sure.
Yeah. This, I wrote it from, that is part also of the book, The Flower Song, and it's called Letter to My Cosita. As a child, you heard murmurs of the earth, women's voices whispering, la cosita, la cosita, the shy flower, the cuddly, the sleeping flower, possible green lights leave. My mother, my aunt, my neighbors call you, la cosita, la cosita. Their echoes carried by the October wind seep into the Milky Way band of libellulas, dragonflies. Dragonflies, there's cositas, secret gardens of hibiscus flowers, orange, red, and tangled, the undergrowth braiding themselves into clouds. And mommy's cosita arose like her name in a raised bed populated by a sweet memory. But not everything is color, cosita. You are vulva, and my fifth grade friend never said anything. A little girl with her broken cosita crushed the violet orchid when she died. A whore, said the rapist, mouth like a straight-edged razor. Mercedes, Cande, Concepcion, they never knew how to spell you, cosita, let alone find the tilde of your petal. You reach adolescence, delicate, crystal, illuminated pomegranate of August, reborn, volcanic, crater, eruption of Christmas flare, spilling red ribbons. I am alive! I am alive! You shouted. Vulva, spring, butterfly, with newly hatched wings. You borrow the essence of the earth. Take possession of beauty. The trees become wild, wild. You enjoy the day's radiance. And like the swallows, you flew away from the maze wave of the sea. You made it to your 20s. You know your petal tip, little match head in your cave. I ran through your fingers up bonfires. And I pronounce you, write you, shout you, my vulva, nupashpai nawat, a word that my mother, my aunts, my sisters, my cousins, my young girlfriends, my little girls who became mothers never, never allowed themselves to call you, to pronounce you freely, shout, exalt, my vulva, my flower heart. Thank you.
I like it. I like the images you use in both poems that you've read so far. I have a question because I just thought about it. Your first language is Spanish. When you write the poems, do you write in Spanish or are you writing as you write them in English?
You know, I do it both. I mean, if someone asks me to write them in English, like sometimes they ask me, do you have a poem that you can, you know, for this theme, I go straight to English. But when I have to do it in Spanish, I go straight to Spanish too. So I do it both. And I translate my own work because I know what I write in English. So I I know Spanish is first language. So I do both. I mean, I do back and forth. Yeah.
In the writing process, because I was actually talking to a friend of mine, some people write and they don't touch the work again. Do you edit a lot or do you just like it the way it comes out?
No, I do go through different drafts, yeah. Sometimes it will come, I mean, the way I wanted it, but I go through and I read it aloud. Sometimes I even act in my poems and like a theater or my writing stories mm-hmm. or like I'm doing the novel. I do go through different different drafts.
No, I remember a long time ago I was at a workshop. I wasn't participating. I was just at a friend's house. And some guy spent this long speech telling everybody it took him 5 years to write the poem. I didn't want to tell him what I thought about it because it wasn't good for 5 years of work. You know? I just thought it was funny. But, yeah, everybody has their process. Everybody writes differently.
Yeah.
I've come to know.
Everybody, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like any other art, I mean, painters or theater people, you know, you practice until you get what you mm-hmm. want. Sometimes, I mean, the first part, I guess, is, I wouldn't say inspiration, I mean, because I don't believe in inspiration. I do believe that people need to do it. You know, you have to write every day. If you were doing that, you have to, I mean, and I say every day, no, in a way, oh, I have a 7 a.m. in the morning, which I do sometimes, but no, I have to write. But, you know, I mean, make it a part of your life in a way. Like,
Yeah.
Any other arts, right? You know, when I was doing theater, I live there in the, you know, in the theater, practicing all the time, you know, the my lines, and also because I had directing also theater, so it's a, it's, you know, any it's like any other art, you it's work, right?
Yeah, I had a book of poet laureates of America, and one poet laureate said he'd wake up at 4 a.m. and write his poetry, so the rest of the time was for his other job and his family. So he would specifically start writing poetry early in the morning because he didn't want to lose time from his family.
Yes, well, your work and family, yeah, well, you live in a here now in this country that, well, I think anywhere, I mean, you are a writer, you are an artist. Yeah, I work also as a teacher, and you have to find the time to write,
Some of the funniest things to me are, I mean, me and my friend Yago talked about it, that, you know, most writers have day jobs.
Yeah.
Writers who strictly go, I'm going to become a poet and make money, that's a little delusional. You need to have some, you need to have a job to have experiences to do your writing. If you just concentrate on being a working poet, what are you writing about? Writing about being a, trying to be a poet, get jobs.
Well, this is the only country I heard about the poets will say that I want to make money, because I never heard in other countries, especially in the suburbs, no one will say that. And also, I think writing in a way, I mean, especially if you're writing poetry, but anything, I mean, I guess it's a responsibility of the writer or why you are doing it, you know? Why are you writing? Why you are doing it, this, right? So it's a... because whatever we write, whatever we said, I mean, you know, people are reading you. And what you are saying, you have to be responsible, right? But if you're making money, so what do you want to write? I don't know,
I just find it kind of fascinating, because, I mean, if I didn't have my experiences, I wouldn't have anything to write about. You know, if I was, you know, the bad person at work or, whatever affects you. You need things to affect you to write, I think. That's me.
Yes. Well, you have to have experiences. You have to live. I mean, we write from what we are, no? I mean, or are we what we write? You know, it's like, that's an experience. And reading is another thing, like, important to read. Although I would say I didn't, there were not many books when I was growing up at my home. There were not many books, eventually when I went to elementary school or junior high, you know, I kind of started reading, and then high school I just went to find books everywhere, wherever I wanted to get them. But people need to read. Reading is an experience, and it's something that will change you, So I will invite people to read more, I think, To write it, to read also.
I think people should read more. The problem is now we have the cell phone that distracts everybody, where they do everything on their phone or their tablet, and they don't really read much, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, they don't read. I mean, like I said, I'm a teacher, and I see many students. Yeah, they don't even want to read, I mean, big books. I mean, they just want to read short, and I think it's the font. And the way you write, I mean, people right now, text messages and all that, they just write little things, you know. They don't even complete a sentence.
It's kind of frustrating.
It is. It's a difference. The new generation needs to think about where they want to go with it, so where is their future.
I don't think they're worried about it too much, unfortunately. Who are your inspirations? Because I think the first poet that I liked was Langston Hughes when I was younger, and then I moved on to Neruda.
Oh, yes, Neruda.
Well, everybody likes Neruda.
Pablo Neruda. Pablo Neruda is the Bible for Latin, for a lot of poets in Latin America. Yeah, we always, it was the poet that I will read also.
Any other poets to inspire you? Because I know Neruda and Lorca was both inspired by Ruben Dario. But, I mean, who inspired you?
That inspired me?
Yep.
I shared with you that before that I mute one of the things that poets, I would say, music was something that I really inspired me more like to write. When I was listening a lot of music, especially like, you know, Benny Moré and all that, because my dad was a lover of Benny Moré and Pérez Prado.
Okay.
So that was the thing that we used to hear when I was little, and I used to copy all the lyrics. The same thing like Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Muddy Blues, Silvio Rodriguez, so a lot of them.
Oh, nice.
So actually poetry came to me through the music, the lyrics. And it was until I went, you know, I started reading more books, because like I said, I didn't have books around my,
you
me, you know,
books, yeah.
But I would say that even Roque Dalton, which is the poet from my country, couldn't read it because, I mean, we were in the Civil War and we couldn't read. It was a, you know, very repressive time, and we couldn't read them, you know, all these writers. Even Pablo Neruda, I don't remember, I mean, was part of when I was in the 80s, and Salvador was an adolescent. But I started reading more and more, I mean, when I was in the English department doing my English lit. I get Maya Angelou, a lot of writers in the English language, I mean, Keats, you know, John Keats. But in Spanish, Nicolas Guillen from Cuba. I would say there were many, many writers especially this poet, I don't know if anyone knows, but he's from Jamaica, Edward Brathwaite, the Arribont. I really like it a lot. When in English, I would say, yeah, were they. But in Spanish, I would read many. Oswaldo Escobar Velado, you know, Nancy Morejon, the Cuban poet, and of course Pablo Neruda, but many other writers that will be, I mean, the Russian poets. Since I was in the art school in El Salvador, my high school was an art high school, and I was doing theater. So, but most of the literature that I really started reading it seriously was a lot of Russian writers, like Chekhov and Titus, many more. So I wouldn't say that there is only one poet that inspired me, but it was many, many of them. And my aunt, she used to recite poetry, I mean, was one person also that. I guess maybe she did the one that it went to study theater. Yeah, because she used to recite poetry. Yeah. Well,
your inspiration came from music first, because it's interesting, because you mentioned Pink Floyd, and I mean, that's interesting that, you know, where the inspiration comes from. Sometimes it doesn't come from books of poetry; it just comes from different areas. You know, so that's interesting.
Yeah, from the lyrics of music, because that was more, I mean, I was, it's something that I heard it more in my family, like music, and so I used to listen it, and also at school, you know, when we learn English when we are in seventh grade, so there was a teacher who was always bringing us this music, and my friends and I, we were just taking the lyrics, and we would be, you know, translating them. And we like it, but my brother was a lover of music too, you know, of Led Zeppelin and Muddy Blues and all that. But it was until I went, I turned 16, and my teen years where I started listening to Silvio Rodriguez, and it just blew up my mind. I was like, wow, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that Cuban singer, yeah, I was like, oh, wow, this guy is a poet, man. He is a poet, yeah. So I actually come from that, and a lot of musicians, yeah. But books, I would say that I got a lot of books once I went out from El Salvador, yeah.
I like when people can actually meld poetry and music together. It's always, if it's really good, it's really good. You know, when you have a jazz musician behind you, it's always nice. Just the way it flows.
But in a way to to get into poetry through music, because you see it as a, you know, you need a guitar, you need an instrument, right? But when I was reading it, I was reading it like a poem, you know, poetry, yeah, and the lyrics. And so I'm a person that I was mostly, yeah, inspired, I would say I grew up, you know, through theater, music, and literature was there, but it was not something that I was around much in El Salvador, yeah.
I kind of had the same thing with literature in high school. I didn't learn anything. I didn't nothing. I learned nothing from high school. I learned it on my own. I had to be curious to learn. They don't really teach you. They don't teach you much. You have to figure it out for yourself. I figured that out a long time ago.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, I was in a school that it was the art school. So, yeah. I mean, and like I said, it was in the 80s. You know, we went going through a civil war. And so it was a really, I mean, a harvest of many people, you know, going around with a lot of creativity. And so I was around there. So that's just the way I learned, I mean, about the Russian writers. It wasn't until I went to high school, yeah. It's different. I guess, I don't know, where did you go to high school?
I went to about three different high schools because I kept getting kicked out. They weren't that great. I mean, I wasn't that good, but I mean, the high schools here, I mean, if you missed about 3 months, they didn't really help you, you know, catch up. So you're basically, you know, left dangling on your own, you know?
Yeah. I don't know how it's going to be, how I was going to be if I were going to school here, high school. Yeah, I have seen them, yeah. My school was very small. We have only 200 students, yeah.
Well, I think that's probably more beneficial. I mean, our government complains about Cuba, but I hear their education's great, you know?
Yes.
I think education's important. That's really important, but unfortunately, we don't really focus that well on it in America.
It's true. It's right. Yeah.
Mhm. Yeah. So it's like I like the fact that you know a lot of poetry. You don't. A lot of the younger poets don't know a bunch of poets' names. They haven't sought out to learn more about poetry. They just write their work. You know, I think that's all go ahead.
There is something, there is something here. I don't know, maybe not in all the schools, but the kids, I don't know, they are not interested in reading. I guess maybe teachers need to work it out the way. I mean, I taught a class in about 10 years ago in a high school, and it was a high school that it was about, what do they call the bone? You know, the people who need the class to pass it to graduate, right? It was a Spanish class they needed to have. And I did it with them, and I taught them a lot of poetry with music. I brought my drums and my congas. And I think that's the way to teach it. I mean, it was not easy, but most of the students, I said, you know what, you have to go through this. They didn't want to read. That's the issue, right? They don't want to. So I just brought a lot of poetry, and they needed to read Don Quixote, and, you know, they would never, come on, Don Quixote is a big book, and they needed to read some parts. Yeah. So we had to do it as a poem in order to, they needed to read it, and then I just played the music, you know, we play music in order, and they were playing the drums, and they did it, but hopefully, they will remember them, you know, they just did it to pass the class, right? But it's not easy to ask them to read poetry. Yeah.
I read Don Quixote. Don Quixote is a hard book to read. Don Quixote is not an easy book. Don Quixote is not an easy book.
No, it's not easy. Yeah, it's not easy. But you know what? I read it when I was in high school. So, I mean, in Salvador. But here, I would say that they needed. I just took parts, you know, chapters that they would be interested. Yeah. Especially the people like it, the students like it, the part where Marcela, the is looking for, you know, the poet is looking for her. There is one mm-hmm. part, one chapter in Don Quixote where a poet is looking for Marcela because he is in love with her, and Marcela doesn't want to be the muse.
Mm-hmm.
So Don Quixote is looking for her to give her, to bring her back from the forest, to bring her back from the to the poet, and then she said, you know what, no, I don't want to be the muse. So they really like it. I mean, it was so, we talk about feminists now, but, you know, Don Quixote, Miguel de Cervantes was writing about that in those days. Oh, about the literature, poetry, yeah.
I had to cut you off now, but it's been great talking to you. We've actually hit the 30 minutes. Quick question before we let you go. Do you have any readings coming up? Do you have anything coming out? Are there any things that you want to promote that are important that are coming out for you?
No, right now I'm concentrating in writing the novel and also to put sending the book, the poetry book out. And hopefully it will be published this year. And I will let you know.
All right. And we've been talking to Carolina Rivera, and I'm going to mess up the last name.
Carolina Rivera Escamilla.
So you say it a lot better than I do. I like the way your name sounds, and I didn't want to ruin it. But thank you. But thank you for coming on the show. It's been great talking to you, and thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for you too, for spare me this time, okay? And I hope I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you very much.
Too. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Right. And now we have Boyd Dunleavy. Did I pronounce that right?
You got it. Look at you.
Wow. Holy crap. That happened.
Well,
that never happens.
I'm
usually
flexible.
Mess up names. And, wow.
I'm Canadian, so I'm flexible.
That's cool. So,
yeah.
You survived cancer and you're still running. Actually, tell me about that.
So just to clarify two things, I was not a runner prior to my cancer diagnosis. I was a father with three young children and was working in banking and just wasn't feeling well and randomly went to the doctor and was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia, which if you want to look up is a very serious blood cancer diagnosis, and the long-term prognosis is absolutely horrible. It's like a 10% chance of living the year, and that was in July of 2011. And so went through about five or six rounds of chemotherapy and radiation, including having my cancer, unfortunately, relapse in February of 2012, just because the Canadian health care system was overwhelmed with patients fighting blood cancer. And you have to be in remission to have a life-saving stem cell transplant. So I guess that's the most important part of the story is they found a stem cell donor in the fall of 2011, but you have to be in remission, and you have to be in remission for a certain period of time to be able to do it. So blood cancer twice in 8 months, a lot of chemotherapy and radiation, and May 3rd, I believe it was, of 2012, I had a life-saving stem cell transplant. That was probably the most difficult thing I've ever been through. It is radiation and chemotherapy that just basically wipes out your entire immune system, and then you're given somebody else's DNA. You give somebody else's stem cells. And so during those treatments, unfortunately, I went through, suffered a brain injury from chemotherapy and spinal cord trauma, but in spite of all that, in the spring of 2013, I actually started running, and a friend ran a marathon for me in Alaska, which inspired me to start running, and that was kind of the turning point for me running. It was about the same time in 2013 that we discovered that the random donor that donated his stem cells to save my life was an American naval serviceman. Now, his name is Nathan Barnes. Nathan is from somewhere like Idaho and has been deployed since he was 18 years old and was overseas in Japan when he got the call. And it was really quite interesting. We just did a couple of days with his family here at Disney, like in the last 2 days. And so I got some details that I didn't know before. And one of them was the thing that inspired him to put his name in the BeTheMatch.org registry was a simple cheek swab. You put your name in the registry through a cheek swab, but he was given the day off. And so that was his joke, you know. Oh, well, you know, I'll just do a cheek swab. And, you know, because you'll never get the call to save somebody's life. And it was 5 years later that he got the call to donate his marrow. So, yeah. So he saved my life. And a different friend took me to Alaska and started running for me. And so I started running and joined the running community in 2013 and worked my way up from local 10K half marathon races to the January of 2015 was the Disney Marathon here in Florida. And to say it was a life-changing moment really, I guess, would be an understatement. You know, I don't want to take away from a 5K or a 10 or even a half marathon, but there's just something special about running 26.2 miles. And that particular marathon weekend was very special. I was invited to share on stage in front of all the runners beforehand. And was told by the people here at Disney that I had an important story. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things you don't really realize the importance of the story until, or at least for some people, until people keep telling you, you know, you have an important story. And so anyways, I'll take it back to running as an athlete with disabilities, balance issues and other things. I was actually found out after running Disney that I had qualified to run Boston under their Athletes with Disabilities program. And I guess the other part to that was 99% of people in the run community are just absolutely incredible people. But, you know, the one particular individual that said I would never run Boston really got under my skin. And so, so I went 3 straight years. And I actually beat that particular individual at Boston in 2017 by 1 minute. It wasn't some big thing. And, you know, 26 miles, a lot of things can go wrong over 26 miles. But I've been told by my mother-in-law I'm a pretty determined individual. And so, anyways, I was given your name through a gentleman named Sanjay, who is a fellow Canadian. I guess I should talk about that. We're Canadians. And so to have an American save your life has really been quite a humbling experience, but we're Canadians. And you know, Sanjay is just a perfect example of people that are just amazing in the community. And so I've been running since the summer of 2013, and marathons are hard. They're hard for me, and I think most people would agree. And then you turn around and see people running ultra marathons, right? So... I did 7 marathons in 7 years while I was waiting to meet my stem cell donor, Nathan. And so people are sort of curious, you know, why didn't you meet up with him sooner? Because we both had a willingness. And that's another thing, too, that I want to highlight. When somebody donates their stem cells, or in my case, I receive somebody else's stem cells, they make both parties wait a year because a lot of times people, they don't make it. They don't live the year, they die. It's such a difficult, horrible process to go through. And so we connected in the spring of 2013. And you know, like I had said earlier, it just happened to coincide within a few months. A friend took me to Alaska and ran a marathon for me with the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. And, you know, it was a life-changing moment. A year and a half later, it was my first marathon at Disney. And one of the highlights for me, I guess, too, was being welcomed into the Run Disney community. And Some people in the Run Disney community would know of Jeff Galloway, who has advocated a lot for the community. And I remember the first time I met him in 2015, he was just so amazed to hear that I had blood cancer and was a marathon runner. And so, you know, he's another example of somebody that it just means a lot to me to have been welcomed by him into the running community. And so Nathan, my stem cell donor, this is like a 7-year journey that I'm sort of weaving back and forth with. We were like, when are we going to meet Nathan? When are we going to do this? How are we going to do this? But he just kept moving around, and because he was deployed. And so I know for a fact that he had gone from Japan to San Diego, back to the naval base in Japan. I'm not sure which one it is. It's in the south of Japan. I believe at some point he was in Afghanistan. I could be wrong. But, you know, you would appreciate, I assume, when somebody's in active service, they're there when the military needs them. And so, anyways, in 2019, the proverbial stars sort of aligned that we might be able to meet up with Nathan, but it was kind of one of those things. We needed to plan the trip months in advance, and the entire 7 months of planning this trip, it was kind of one of those things that if he gets deployed again, it's not going to come together. And so, anyways, Disney was quite thrilled with this story and thought of meeting him for the first time at Disney in November of 2019. Seemed to excite them. Disney, as you know, likes these sort of tragedy to triumph stories, right? But a lot of times, you know, somebody has to overcome adversity to do great things. And so I don't claim to be anything more than myself, but it seemed to resonate with the folks that run Disney. And so anyways, November of 2019 is still a tremendous highlight for me because it was all recorded on camera, and you can Google Boyd Dunleavy at Disney. The video and the blog still up, which is really kind of neat. But I brought my mom and my mother-in-law and my wife and three children. We have three kids. And we came back to Disney. And we had done, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 trips to Disney over the years. So that was another thing, too, right? Like, when are we going to meet Nathan? So my two things that were the highlights for me were running marathons and going to Disney. And sometimes it was running a marathon at Disney. And so we got to meet. And when we met, it's a pretty special emotional moment that, you know, still kind of resonates with me. And then 2 days later, at the end of the Wine and Dine Half Marathon, which is a very popular race at Disney in November, he gave me my medal. And so that was us meeting. I've done all the talking. I'm sorry.
No.
You want to jump in with anything?
I enjoyed it. I mean, I love when someone actually has something to say, because it's a lot easier when the guest can actually tell their story than having to prod it out. And, you know, it's just
if my wife is here, she'd say shut up, you've talked too much. So I'm trying. I'm trying to be.
You're a host's dream. You know, because it's like
okay. Thank you for your
information. you told me a lot, and it's great. I mean, right now, how many marathons have you done in total?
Well, that was the interesting thing, right? So 7 marathons, 7 years waiting to meet Nathan. And it was one of those things. It was like the stars seemed to fall into place, because one of my other goals was to I've been told by the doctors in Ontario, I'm one of the first people in Canada and first people in Ontario where we lived to have had a stem cell transplant that's become a marathon runner. And those were their words, not mine. So it's like, okay, well, it would be a big dream to run the 6 major marathons, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with.
Yeah.
So I had run Boston multiple times. So that one was done. And ran Chicago in 2017, which was a great race. It was flat, and it's still my fastest marathon. But in 2018, I ran New York, which was by far my most favorite marathon. There was just a lot of energy, and my wife came with me for the weekend, and we left the kids with grandma, and it was probably one of my favorite marathons. No, it is my favorite marathon. And so anyways, I'd been approved to run the London, England marathon and the Berlin marathon in 2020. And I don't need to bring up what happened with COVID. Everything kind of went to smithereens. And so, actually not because of COVID, but because of my own choices, I said, well, I can't control that, but I can control myself. And so I got serious and lost the last 10 pounds and, you know, started being more mindful with vitamins and health products and that kind of stuff. And really just had a great 2020 running. I mean, I'm kind of guessing, but I ran something like 3,475 kilometers, which is like 2,300 or 2,400 miles in the year, which is a lot of running. That was a great year for me. It was. That was the most I'd ever run in a year. And it wasn't obviously racing. It was just running for the sake of running. And spring of 2021, we were in London, Ontario, which is 2 hours from Toronto, 2 hours from Detroit, southwest Ontario. We saw the demand for real estate just skyrocket in Canada, at least. I don't know what happened in the U.S., so I'm not going to comment, but my wife said, do you want to move to the Maritimes? And I watched something on Facebook Live, I think by the undercover billionaire Grant Cardone. He said, hey, just say yes to everything and figure it out. So I said, yes, let's move to the Maritimes. And she's like, that's not like you at all. You didn't even pivot. I'm like, I'm trying to be a new me. So we packed up and moved to the Maritimes. And it was a really neat thing. We got out there. And because the Maritimes had been a bit stricter with their COVID restrictions, they were able to offer in-person races where other parts of Canada had no races. And so the fall of 2021, I'm like, oh crap, the whole marathon thing had sort of slid by the, you know, you can't rest on your laurels, the whole seven marathon thing. So anyways, ran two marathons in Nova Scotia, which is near where we live in New Brunswick, couple hours away. So I did two marathons in a month, which I had never done, which is really hard. I mean, just in context, I live with chronic nerve pain. I live with brain trauma. So my balance isn't that great. I'm allowed a guide runner. And so I ran those two marathons, and it was kind of one of those things, like it blew out a bunch of toenails, like my big toe nail on my right foot. Yeah, is still growing back, and that's been 8 months. That toenail is like black, and this is like the end of the thing. So anyways, I ran those two marathons, and I really felt like God was leading me to go back to Boston. And so it was this really special moment, because when I did those three Bostons, I was content and done. 2016, 2017, and 2018, and people that are familiar with the 2018 Boston Marathon, it was horrible. It was cold. There was rain, there was wind, people were collapsing. It was a traumatic year. And it was the worst weather Boston had had in something like 35 years. And so I thought, well, I'm done. But I felt like, well, why not go back? And so a friend of mine named Phil, who I had met in Chicago, he was a fellow Canadian who lived in Toronto, but he's actually from the Maritimes. And so I saw him last fall. He had come out to New Brunswick to see his mom and dad, and we were hanging out, and I just called him up at Christmas, and I said, Phil, what would you think about going to Boston? And he was in tears. He was just overjoyed. He's a much better runner than me, but I'm sure you can appreciate there are some people that are excellent that just won't qualify for Boston. And so that's sort of the category where he's at, and maybe he will one day. He just keeps getting faster and better, but he's off by about 15 minutes because he's in his early 40s. And so anyways, my Facebook page is from blood cancer to the Boston Marathon, and my Instagram is from blood cancer to Boston. So you kind of get the idea. It wasn't selling out or quote unquote, just Boston, to go back to Boston. It was really quite a special moment. So I went back this year, and in April, which was right around the, right a few weeks before the May 3rd anniversary of my stem cell transplant, was my 10th marathon. So I have now run 10 marathons in 10 years since my life-saving stem cell transplant. And God bless Phil, who really pushed me. It was actually my fastest Boston by about 7 minutes, and my third fastest marathon overall. So, you know, the saying, hard work pays off. And so that's where I'm at with the 10 marathons.
I'm only up to like 9 right now.
So the disabled athlete has done one more than you. I'm just teasing you.
Basically. Actually, lately,
but, you know,
I mean,
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say our friend Sanjay's done like, what, 75 or 90?
Yeah.
Something crazy. You're racing against yourself. I'm teasing you. You know that you're racing against yourself.
No.
You know?
I mean, you know what the funny thing is? I chase people sometimes just so I can, in a marathon, I'll pick somebody I want to keep up with. You know, just to chase them. You know, just to try to keep up,
right.
So I keep my pace up. It doesn't have to be a boy or a girl. It just has to be somebody that you focus on to keep you going.
It's the it's the proverbial, I don't know if you've heard the idea that there's a string around your waist tied to their waist and they're pulling you.
Yep.
Like it's in your mind's eye, right? That guy or gal in front of you that you want to catch. Yeah, I totally get it.
Another guy Sanjay had on, he's like 75, he's done 503 marathons. He basically said something about everything's in the mind. So basically, I've been running 15 miles a day for the last 6 days, and it's become easier, but I've managed to lose my voice in the process.
That's okay. You know what was really interesting? I'll tell you a side note. In 2020, I had a friend that I was talking to, you know, via Zoom, and I said, I was inspired by the Iron Cowboy. You might have heard of the guy that did 50 Ironmans in 50 days in 50 states.
Wow.
And so I said, well, yeah, it's crazy. You can look it up on Netflix, right? So I just said, I'm going to do 12 half marathons in 12 days before Christmas because, you know, it's Christmas. So I did that on a treadmill because indoors in Canada is the only option in December. I'm sure you can appreciate that. And so I did it. And it was so hard. But I'm telling you, my friend, by day 3 or 4, you push through. I didn't want to stress my wife out. So I didn't. She knew I was running, but I didn't want to tell her what my goal was because it would just stress for her, right? There's nothing she could do to.
Okay.
I don't know. I wasn't lying. It was just told her when it was done, right? And so, anyway.
Oh, yeah. You know, considering her feelings and, like, not freaking her out.
Right. Yeah. So, but I found actually my pace was improving. My time was dropping. And I did it, 12 half marathons in 12 days. And, like, on the 12th day, I was wearing a Santa hat at the end. And it was pretty cool. I didn't think it was possible, but I'm sure you would agree with the saying, the body will achieve what the mind believes is possible. So when you go from saying I can't do something to maybe I can, kind of like the little engine that could, I think I can, to actually starting to do it, and then in your own way and in your own mind saying that you can do this or that you're awesome, your body actually comes into line. And so you said you're on day 15 of at least 10 miles a day?
Yep.
Is that correct?
I used to.
What?
No, 15.
What's your goal?
I'm just trying
15
to,
miles a day?
I'm building, I've been doing 15 miles a day for 6 days. The thing is, I'm trying to build up the endurance because I have a 31-mile run in August, and then I'm going to try to do a 50-mile run in January. So I'm just trying to get the body used to it.
Are you running indoors or outdoors? Because it's a completely different beast.
Outdoors.
I am 10. Yeah.
I am 10, whether I want to be or not. You know, I'm playing. Because after a while, the shirt becomes pointless because you're sweating like crazy. So fuck, I take the shirt off. By the time I'm done, I'm crispy. I never asked this before, but when you're running, because I visualize, I have no sense of direction. I just run where I run all over,
right.
Just to get the 50 miles. But do you sometimes in your head map it out and like, well, that's not that far. It's only a little bit more.
Well,
and that's what
yeah,
I've been doing lately.
But here's a great way to mess with your mind and just, right, the whole Nike logo, the motto is just do it. And so like I said to you earlier, we just packed up and moved to a province that we knew nobody. I don't know the roots. And so you're kind of guessing, right? And so, yes, I can visualize things, and yes, I'm getting way better at it. And now I know my 5-mile route versus the 10K or the 8-mile or you know, the 13 miles, and it's getting better. But in January of this year, we had 7 feet of snow on our back deck, 7 feet of snow. So I ran something like 450 kilometers and 98% of it was on a treadmill in my garage. It was kind of one of those things. I just did what I needed to do to get it done. But, you know, you visualize what your goal is and you kind of count backwards from this is your timeline is for you, August. And, you know, for me, it's kind of interesting. We've been at Disney for a couple of weeks, but I know how much my body has needed a bit of a break because I got in 1,000 miles of running for the year before we left the end of June. Well, that's a lot of running for anybody. And so we did that, and it's really kind of interesting. I've run once, and it was like, I don't know, 2.5 miles just to go to the store to get some stuff for my wife and come back. We're averaging 20,000 steps a day walking at Disney. And it was 34 degrees here with the heat. So it was between 94 and 99 degrees Fahrenheit with the humidity today. Just walking around at Animal Kingdom. We saw people collapsing. We saw 2 different people collapse from heat stroke.
Yeah, it's funny as I'm trying
anyways,
to
all
build
that.
Up the heat resistance right now. Which, you know.
Yeah, well, that will help. Where's your race in August? I didn't ask that.
It's in the hills, too, which is going to make it a pain in the ass. It's 31 miles in the hills.
Right. From what part of the country will you be?
I think it's Southern California. I think near Calabasas or something.
That could be a warm one.
Saturday. Well, the thing is, I got to teach myself how to hydrate again because I've actually run 4 marathons without drinking water, which all my friends think are nuts.
No,
but I
it's feasible. I mean, when I first started running, you know, or you go to a local 5K race, and these people are sucking down 17 liters of water, or they're wearing a Camelback on a 5K.
Yeah, okay.
Like,
that's funny.
Well, you can,
that's funny.
it's hilarious. It's hilarious. But you can teach yourself to do it. But,
well, yeah,
you know, you're right. I don't know. I mean, slow sipping, right? So that might be a thing to look at. But
no, that's what I did before.
The last thing that I would recommend that you consider is are you implementing things like gels and
I'm actually
you know, some
to
people will.
I got to learn how to do that. The gels and things. The thing you got to be particular. Gels are funky. So if you eat the wrong gel, you're going to find yourself right into the bathroom.
I totally did that during Boston this year. I got like upset stomach. Somebody handed me something, right? And so I thought I was going to throw up and was getting lightheaded and feels like, what the heck were you doing? I'm like, I don't know.
Well,
I just say yes to everything and just grabbed a thing.
No, it's just bad stuff. I mean, I'm kind of crazy because I've actually, while running, puked about 3 or 4 times but kept going.
Right.
You know, just to finish my run. It's kind of like, I noticed that people tell me I'm not that crazy because most runners are that stubborn. You know, you just want to keep going. Like,
I kind of belched out whatever was bothering me during Boston, like a mad belch and, you know, just got it out of my system and drank enough water and flushed it down. It was really funny, though, because, like, Phil, running as my guide runner, was holding on to these gels, right? And he did.
Yeah.
He just stops a fan who was standing there. He hands them to her, goes, "Can you hold these, please?" And just hands them to her, like, in this serious face. So, of course, she takes them from him, right? I'm like, why were you holding these stupid things? Why didn't you just chuck them on the ground like everybody else does? But it kind of felt like, you know, the proper authoritarian thing to do to...
That's funny.
To whatever with the gels. But I see we're running out of time. I guess the last thing that I wanted to share is...
No, we got enough. I mean, I always book this thing over so I can go over.
Okay. I'm also thrilled to announce that I've been approved to run the Berlin Marathon this fall. So that will be...
Oh, man, you know what? I got to bring you on the show after you do that one. I need to hear about that one.
I know.
Just because it's a different country, it's a different course, and it's a different community.
And they're running
so
kilometers.
I'm definitely interested in them.
They're running kilometers. Come on. You know, eight of my 10 marathons were in the USA. Right? So everything's in miles. Boston, they do miles and kilometers. But the two marathons that I did in Canada were kind of bizarre because they're in kilometers. And I'm like, hey, that's the pace that I run in. But the thing with Berlin also is everybody that I've talked to has said it's a very fast, flat race. I've been hoping to get into Berlin since 2016, so I'm thrilled that this has only taken 6 years. And also, it was September of 2011 that the doctor said I wouldn't live the year. So
there you go.
11 marathons in 11 years since then. Yeah. You know, the guy that said I wouldn't live the year, I laughed at him. So we'll see. Right? The guy that said I would never run Boston, I said, I don't think so. And, you know, my mother-in-law was the one that said I was one of the most determined people she had ever met. So I guess she didn't know a lot of people in the running community, but it doesn't surprise me that you've done this. And we've never met. You can share that with your listeners. We met through a friend in common, and there's just this sort of spirit of a runner that's a spirit of overcoming, a spirit of determination, a spirit of excellence. I mean, what would you say that spirit is?
For me, it's very driven because I mean, the endorphin high it's a pretty intense thing when you're really into it. You know, when you're just going.
Right.
You feel it.
Is a huge thing. And it's also, you know, can't remember where I heard it, but it's something along the lines of that men learn more through adversity and difficulty than they learn through living an easy life. And maybe it's people in general.
Oh.
But something like half of the presidents of the United States, and I'm not saying it 100% accurate, but something like half of them had a parent die as a child, and because they had that, they faced that adversity, they rose up and they overcame.
Oh, yeah.
I liked being a fat, overweight mortgage broker who had three young kids.
Yeah.
This leaner, thinner me,
yeah.
10 years
later,
hard work.
I can relate. I was beat up from first grade to seventh grade, became a bully, got stronger, and then, you know, realized I shouldn't be a bully. But, you know, at the same time, it's, if you don't have a life lived and you don't have any experiences, and it's like kids, I mean, I don't want to be one of those old fuckers that says kids today, but a lot of people are soft where I work.
Oh,
it's weak and
it's pathetic. And I just spent 2 days with my stem cell donor and his family here at Disney. Like, that's something I waited years to do. Like, we wanted to do it after COVID, but because of, or after we met, but then because COVID hit in 2019, or late 2019, right, COVID-19 rolled out in March of 2020, we waited 2 years for this moment. And so anyways, we were at a restaurant yesterday, and I said to our server, seemed like a really neat young man, I said, you know what the saddest location in any city is? He goes, what's that? I said, it's a cemetery. It's the graveyard. He's like, yeah, because of all the dreams that were never lived. I said, exactly. Right? So the saddest part of any city is the graveyard, because people don't live a fulfilling life. And, I mean, you know, again, we haven't met in person yet, but I'm thrilled to share with you that the life I've lived, I'm beyond proud of. I don't think it's
going to be
as my goal is to run the world major marathon circuit, but I don't have these regrets of, oh, man, if I had only done this, or why didn't I do that kind of thing. And, you know, I know people that have regrets. And, you know, a lot of people, they, where they were is in high school of like this thing that was like the most important moment in their life. And for me, you know, I'm 47 now, I never thought I'd be this person. But
I'm 56. You're making me feel old.
But you're a way better you than you thought you could ever possibly be. And I know I am also, and I know people that want to listen to
that. You know what? That I think, like you said, our experiences are what build us. And I notice right now people don't have that many good experiences. They're not challenged enough or whatever. I don't know. I mean,
they're not pushed. They're not pushed.
I mean, I write sometimes when I'm running, I'll write like a poem and like I'll write a line each mile. So, I mean, there's the word push always comes in the poem because I'm always, at some point I'm talking that I'm still pushing myself because I am. Because, you know.
Right. The thing that I say to my kids is bring it. So they know over and over again, bring it. And it's not necessarily running for them, but when you're doing your thing, bring your best you. If you're in school, bring your best you. If you're working your job, bring your best you. If you're doing whatever, bring your best you because...
You're the only one
that can say what you can or can't do.
Well, no, I mean, you have to. I mean, you have to show yourself and your own sense of pride, and you know, whatever you want to present in the world, you're presenting yourself. It's when I'm running, I try to like just be, like, you know, keep my pace up, be careful, and like know my limits, know that I'm going to try to push my limits, but at the same time, know that if I hit 10 miles, I'm good. I can stop and not be ashamed. But I want 15, so I'll push for 15, you know.
That's
so there's always
crazy.
That negotiation in your head. It's like, you know, I could do 15.
15 miles outside
I don't need
in
my
California,
voice.
Yeah.
I don't need my voice that badly. I mean, it'll come back eventually.
You just bring on loudmouths like me that just talk for 30 minutes, so you don't have to.
No, it's like, you know, this morning when I woke up, because I wake up like sometimes 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, it's like, I could sleep in. And then I go get my pre-workout, and that's basically crashed after I drink the damn thing. And then I'm like, okay, now I got to get rid of all this energy.
Right.
But it's been great talking to you. I definitely want to talk to you after you do with Berlin, because I just like hearing about, I love the stories, you know, and I love the tips that I get from other runners, you know, I mean.
I could have talked for an hour about all my different running adventures, whether it's Boston or Disney or any of these things. It's always an exciting thing, but I look forward to talking to you this fall.
No, that'd be great.
Thank you for your time.
I definitely enjoyed your story. And it's definitely the whole point that I like about these shows is, you know, I like having beginners, intermediate, elite, whatever, just because you're running, you're doing it. It doesn't matter, you know, if you've been doing it forever, it's just the effort that matters.
Just put in the effort. Be your best you. Yeah, exactly. Thank you for your time.
Well, thanks a lot for being on the show, and I'll send you the link right afterwards, and I'll probably send it to Sanjay, too, right away, so he can listen to it, because he always wants to listen to the people he recommends to me.
Exactly.
That way, actually.
Appreciate it, sir. he's a wonderful guy. He is what the community is about. Have a good day.
All right. So everybody knows I've been taking this Bolt from 6 a.m. run. 30 minutes before I run is great. If you're tired and sleepy and you need a little boost, Bolt from 6 a.m. run is a great pre-workout for running. And also their finishing line is good for recovery. If you need something to help you recover from your runs, I actually recommend anytime you run, have something to recover to build back the aminos, the electrolytes. Actually, I recommend now to find an electrolyte drink that you like when you're running because you don't want to dehydrate. I've been stupid. I'm going to probably get one soon. Thank you for listening to Poet Runner, and we'll be back next week, I believe, with Douglas Kearney, one of my favorite poets. Thank you for listening. End episode.